1 Samuel 5:1 through 7:2. Previously, we considered how God promised to make an end of the wicked house of Eli, and how he ultimately did so by destroying them in battle, a battle in which the Ark of the Covenant was lost to Philistia. This week, we will be considering 1 Samuel 5:1 through 7:2, which tells the story of the events surrounding the Ark of the Covenant after it had been taken in battle. The Philistines surely rejoiced in having taken the Ark at first, but their joy quickly turned to misery as Jehovah defended the Ark against them. He toppled the Philistine god Dagon in his temple and sent a plague on the people of Philistia. Before long, the Philistines were ready to send the Ark back, and that's exactly what they did. Today's story serves to demonstrate to us that God, though he may have allowed a battle to be lost, was not powerless to have won it if he had so desired. God, unlike the pagan gods, is powerful to do as he pleases. In this case, it simply pleased him for Israel to lose the battle so that the house of Eli would fall. Your passage for consideration, then, is 1 Samuel 5:1 through 7:2, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. The Ark of the Covenant was taken to Ashdod. Ashdod, as this passage notes, was one of the five chief cities of the Philistines, those being Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, Gaza, and Ekron. Ashdod was in territory which had been allotted to Judah, but which, at this time, was under Philistine control. Ashdod was almost directly west of Jerusalem, not more than a few miles from the seashore, and that location is well known. Unlike Ekron and Gath, also prominent in today's story, Ashdod is still populated today and is a major city in modern Israel. The remains of all of these ancient cities have been excavated by archaeologists, though, and so far as I can tell, no one disagrees that they were populated by Philistines at the time when this story occurred and were part of what is now called the Philistine Pentapolis, or five capital cities. In Ashdod, the Ark was brought into the Temple of Dagon. Dagon was the chief god of the Philistines. For more on him, you could listen to our message, Samson's Death, published January 24th of 2021. Samson also had been brought into a temple of Dagon, where he died. However, it evidently was not this one in Ashdod, but one which had been in Gaza. You will recall that Samson brought down that temple, resulting in many deaths, his own included. And it is here that we should make clear the nature of Philistine idolatry. The Philistines were worshiping a rock. Dagon was a statue in a temple, a carving from a rock. The Philistines did not believe that this statue was a mere representation of a transcendent being. They believed that this rock was the physical embodiment of the god. It was not uncommon in the ancient Near East for victorious warriors to take the treasures of their enemies and to devote them to their gods by placing them in the temples of those gods. This was a way of showing that their god was superior, and thus that their nation, for whom the god was a patron, was also superior. To put the Ark in the presence of Dagon suggested that Dagon was Jehovah's superior, and thus that Philistia, Dagon's chosen nation, was superior to Israel, Jehovah's chosen nation. The Philistines worshipped a pantheon of idols, and likely they would have also incorporated Jehovah into their hierarchy of gods and worshipped him, likely believing that, since they had, as they supposed, captured him and placed him in their temple, that he also had chosen them and would add his power to theirs. Now, Israel did not have quite the same custom. Obviously, no idols would be permitted in the tabernacle. However, we do see an echo of this custom in that the treasures of Israel's vanquished enemies would be devoted to God as sacrifices. We also note later on in this same book, at 1 Samuel 21:9, that after the death of Goliath, his sword was kept at the tabernacle as a trophy. And so the Ark of the Covenant was brought to the Temple of Dagon, and in the mind of the Philistines, Jehovah was brought along with it, defeated, as they saw it, by Dagon, and now just another idol in his pantheon. This is all quite silly. As we well know, Jehovah is not tied to the Ark of the Covenant or to any other thing. Jehovah is a real, living, transcendent God. The Ark was just a symbol of God and of his connection to the people. Dagon was not a god at all. Dagon was a rock, and that rock was not even a symbol of something greater. It was just a rock that people worshipped. However, the one true God, Jehovah, was prepared to use that rock to demonstrate an important principle to the Philistines, and the principle was this: Dagon is the inferior, and Jehovah the superior. When the men of Ashdod came the next day To see the Ark and to gloat over Dagon's supposed superiority, they found that Dagon had fallen down before the Ark. I suppose we could take this in one of two ways. Perhaps this demonstrates Dagon bowing down to Jehovah as if in veneration, or perhaps it pictures for us Dagon beaten and fallen down dead before the one true God. And my supposition is the latter, because after they stood Dagon up, they found him again the next day, not only fallen, but fallen in such a way that his head and hands had broken off. In this, Dagon is shown to be what he really is, a rock with no capacity to think and no capacity to act, just an old, broken rock in submission to the all-powerful God of the universe. This is a symbol that even the Philistines could recognize, that Jehovah was the greater and Dagon was the lesser. And we have a note in verses 4 and 5 that since Dagon's hands had touched the threshold, the Philistine priests would not touch the threshold, I suppose on the grounds that it had somehow been made holy. A silly superstition. The passage reads as if this aspect of Philistine worship was well known to the Israelites at the time when the book of Samuel was written. This suggests that the book of Samuel was written not too long after the events took place, and also suggests the veracity of the account. The author is pointing us to a piece of evidence for the historicity of his claim. The claim is that Dagon fell down and broke before Jehovah's ark, and the reader could verify this by observing the custom of the Philistines. Dagon's bad fall was only the beginning of Ashdod's troubles. They were afflicted with a plague thereafter. The passage gives three characteristics for this plague. It was a plague of mice, tumors, and death. My supposition is that the plague progressed in that order. Mice brought disease, the disease caused the tumors, and the tumors either caused death or the underlying disease caused the death with tumors as a symptom. Now, the King James translation calls these tumors emerods, that being the alternate term for hemorrhoids. These all translate the Hebrew word tekorim. This word derives from a Hebrew word meaning to burn, and according to Strong's, describes, quote, a boil or ulcer from the inflammations, especially a tumor in the anus or pudenda, end quote. So I'm not exactly sure what Philistia was afflicted with here, but it sounds like some kind of burning inflammation of the nether regions. Very unpleasant, I am sure. Naturally, there was an outcry from the people of Ashdod about this. When the plague hit, they immediately blamed the presence of the Ark for their troubles. And from here, the Philistines engaged in a little experiment, whether intentionally or not. The leadership decided to move the Ark to another city, Gath, evidently with the expectation that the plague would not follow it. They must have thought that the plague was not really caused by the Ark, as the people had claimed. However, when they performed the experiment, they got an unexpected result. The plague did indeed move to Gath. Now, correlation is not causation. Just because the plague moved at the same time as the Ark doesn't mean that the Ark's presence caused the plague. So the experiment might have led them to the correct conclusion, but it doesn't necessarily prove it. Now, thankfully for us, we don't need an experiment to prove what the Bible says. We know it because the Bible says it. Regardless, there was an outcry in Gath, and the Philistine leaders attempted the experiment again, this time sending the Ark to Ekron, but the Ekronites would have none of it. The news of the plague following the Ark had already reached Ekron, and so when the Ark arrived, the city erupted into a panic. We note that the news of the plague had spread there previously, but evidently the plague itself had not. News only spread by word of mouth in those days. Apparently, people traveling from one city to another weren't spreading the disease. Seemingly, only the Ark was. With the Ark in Ekron, God's hand was heavy on them, as expected, and so they also demanded that the Ark be taken away. By the end of 7 months, the plague had spread to all five of Philistia's major cities, and the Philistines were eager to send the Ark back to Israel. Since this was a religious matter, they consulted with the best religious sources they had, not Jehovah's priests in Israel, of course, but their own priests and diviners to ask how they should go about sending the Ark back. If their hope was to appease Jehovah by doing things his way, they failed spectacularly. The Philistine religious leaders came up with pure nonsense to appease Jehovah. They said that a guilt offering should be made to Jehovah, and that makes some sense, but the form of the offering was all wrong. Jehovah's guilt offerings were made with animal sacrifices. The Philistines offered gold, and not just any gold, but gold shaped into images, which you may recall isn't really Jehovah's thing. They decided to offer golden tumors and golden mice following the forms of the plague. Now, how exactly one makes a graven image of a tumor or a hemorrhoid is unclear to me. It seems that such a thing would be somewhat amorphous, but I suppose they did their best. They also decided to return the Ark in the best way that they could come up with. They decided the ark should be pulled by a cart, and not just any cart, but a new cart. The cart would be pulled not by common mules, but by milking cows. A milking cow was particularly valuable. You might note that cows were often held to be of such high worth that they themselves became objects of worship. Aaron had made the golden calf in the wilderness, and Jeroboam, we haven't gotten to him yet, but he'll be in the book of 1 Kings, would set up golden cow idols, etc. And these were not to be just any cows, but the purest milking cows, cows which had never been yoked before. I have no doubt this was the best the Philistines could come up with, but it is, again, not at all what we would expect to please Jehovah. Jehovah insisted that the ark be carried only by the Levites, and that it be carried by hand using long poles, so that the ark itself was never touched. Putting it on a cart was the wrong way to do things. The passage indicates, though, that there was still some skepticism among the Philistines about whether or not the ark was actually the cause of all the trouble, so they decided to try another experiment. No one would lead the cows back to Israel. They would simply hook the cows up and see what the cows did. If the cows went back to Israel, then they would know that Jehovah had caused the plagues because of the ark. In that case, the odds of the cows bringing the ark back to Israel, and particularly to Beth Shemesh, which they had specified, would be pretty bad. In fact, it was the least likely scenario. These cows had never been yoked. We would expect that they would be unaccustomed to pulling a cart anywhere at all, much less down a road. We might expect them to just go to some grass and meander around grazing for a while. The least likely scenario would be that the cows would stay on the road and go straight to a town in Israel, much less Beth Shemesh, which was a small town. In fact, this would be so unlikely that the Philistines rightly supposed that it would only happen if Jehovah himself miraculously guided the cows. So the experiment was set. If the cows went back to Israel, the Philistines would accept it as a sign from Jehovah himself that he had been the cause of the plague. If not, they would chalk it all up to coincidence. Now, we should note, none of this would actually definitively prove anything, but the low likelihood of any of it working out is certainly worthy of some consideration. The Philistines put the plan into action, and work out it did. They hooked up the cows, and immediately the cows went straight to Israel's territory, lowing as they went. Jehovah had indeed caused the plagues because of the ark. The cows took the ark to Beth Shemesh. The name Beth Shemesh means House of the Sun. It isn't a name to be proud of. Evidently, it indicates a location of a shrine for worshiping the sun. While the Bible clearly forbids worshiping the sun and prescribes the elimination of such worship among the people of Israel, it would be little surprise if such activity was ongoing during this time period. Now, it may or may not have been, because we note that the name Beth Shemesh had been around since the time of the conquest. Maybe it was just a holdover from the Canaanite period. However, we recall that these were in the days of a weak and abusive priesthood, and that the people were known to live in unrepentant sin and idolatry, and that as a result of that, they had come under Philistine rule, rule which would have tended to encourage pagan forms of worship. And we recall also, as discussed most recently, that this had all become so bad that God would no longer help his people in battle and even allowed the Ark of the Covenant to be stolen. So I would not be surprised to find them worshiping the sun. There are four locations mentioned in the Bible with the name Beth Shemesh. This also is not surprising. There were probably multiple shrines to the sun throughout the land of Canaan and maybe even throughout Israel, and any such place would be known for that by the people who lived nearby and referenced it. This Beth Shemesh, as today's passage notes, was the one on the border between Israel and Philistia. This places it in the southwest. Joshua's description of the borders of Judah mentions a city called Beth Shemesh at just this location. And in verses 13 through 16, we read of how the men of Beth Shemesh rejoiced that the ark had been returned and offered a sacrifice of thanks to Jehovah, breaking up the cart for use as firewood and using the cows as sacrificial animals. The lords of the Philistines saw this and returned home. But then the men of Beth Shemesh made a fatal error. Some of them looked into the ark. Now, you will recall that the ark is a golden box which housed the Ten Commandments. Normally, the ark was kept away from prying eyes. It would remain in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies, a place that only the high priest could go to, and only at certain times. Whenever the ark was brought out, it was carried with a special covering and with poles so that no one could touch it. The idea here is that God is so holy that man cannot look on him, and the ark, being at the same time the most central representation of God's earthly manifestation, was deserving of similar respect. But in this case, the men of Beth Shemesh apparently violated the protocol and failed to show the proper reverence by actually looking inside the ark. Now, different translations say different things here. The King James says that they looked into the ark. The English Standard says that they looked upon the ark. Both are valid translations. The preposition in question is not specific enough to give a precise description. However, I think the King James probably gets it right here. I don't see how the men of Beth Shemesh could possibly be blamed for looking at the ark. Some cows walked up with it on a cart and there it was. It seems unreasonable to me that they should have immediately averted their gaze. It seems more reasonable to think that they would have incurred trouble after taking positive and unnecessary action by opening the ark to look inside. This also seems like something that they would have done, because they would have wanted to know that the ark had been returned along with its contents, as evidently it was. The number of people who were afflicted for this error is a point of some scholarly dispute. Apparently, a minority of ancient manuscripts lists the number of those who died as being 70 people, while others, in the majority, list 70 and 50,000. That's a pretty big difference. I can see why translators might like the smaller number better. We should think that not many people would have been on hand to look into the ark, and the population of Beth Shemesh, a small town, was surely not as high as 50,000. So, if it is the case that only men from Beth Shemesh who looked into the ark died, then 70 is a more attractive number. However, the passage does not explicitly say that these were all men from Beth Shemesh, nor does it say that these were all people who looked into the ark themselves. In fact, as we noted above, it may have simply described people who looked at the ark. Perhaps, rather than sending the ark back to the tabernacle as they should have, the men of Beth Shemesh put the ark on display, maybe even opened, and that people came from all around to see the show, and God punished all of them for this. Or maybe just a few people looked into the ark and unleashed a plague that harmed not only themselves, but others around them. Plagues tend to work that way. Who knows? They may have gotten the same plague that the Philistines got. If they were, in fact, at a shrine devoted to sun worship, it's hard to see how setting the ark up there would have been any better than the Philistines setting it up before Dagon. Whatever the case, we know what we need to know. God demands respect, and the people of Beth Shemesh disrespected him by disrespecting the ark, and rightly died as a result. Now, lest we think that the ark may simply have been some vector for spreading disease, we should note that the plagues associated with the ark finally stopped here. The men of Beth Shemesh called for the people of Kiriath Jearim. Kiriath Jearim was the city marking the corner border of Benjamin, Dan, and Judah's territory. The men of Kiriath Jearim, presumably their Levites or someone of the priestly line, came and took the ark and brought it back with them. The ark was set up at the house of Abinadab, and Abinadab's son Eleazar was given charge over it. The ark stayed there for 20 years. And this, I think, opens a basket full of questions. Questions like, why send the ark to Kiriath Jearim? We don't have a clear answer for that. The tabernacle had been at Shiloh before the battle. Sometime after that, see 1 Samuel 21, the tabernacle was taken to Nob. Why wasn't the ark brought back to the tabernacle? For that, we have no clear answer. But the ark stayed in Kiriath Jearim for decades. It would not leave Abinadab's house until after David became king, see 2 Samuel 6 for that. The best guess I can come up with is that in the chaos of revolt against Philistia, no one wanted to risk losing the ark again, and so it was kept separate from the tabernacle. Other possibilities include that the people were just so irreverent and disorganized that they didn't really care to do what was right with the ark. Maybe the sudden death of the priests had left them not really knowing what they were supposed to do with it. Or maybe they were all so afraid of it that they preferred not to do anything at all, such that once it landed with Abinadab and people stopped dying, they just left it there. And who was Abinadab? We don't really know, because we don't have him clearly put into any other context. Abinadab was a fairly common name at the time. Saul had a son named Abinadab. David had a brother named Abinadab. This Abinadab could have been just about anyone. Who made the decision to consecrate Abinadab's son Eleazar to take charge of the ark? No answer is given, so we don't know for certain. If the Israelites were continuing to mishandle the ark, why didn't the plagues against them continue until they resolved the matter? We don't know. Whatever the answer to such questions, we get one clear picture for certain. Israel's religious establishment was in a mess from this point until David took the ark to Jerusalem decades later. Israel had been conquered by Philistia in the first place because of their religious misbehavior. That misbehavior continued throughout the Philistine occupation. Let's move on to some practical application. First, we should note plainly that God is not powerless to intervene in human circumstances. For the last few weeks, we've spent time considering what God doesn't do. 2 weeks ago, we discussed the call of Samuel and noted that God's direct intervention into human affairs is rare. We considered that often, those who suppose that God speaks don't really hear the audible voice that Samuel heard. We also noted last week that we can't expect to string God along just by some religious form. Bringing the Ark of the Covenant into battle didn't help Israel win. The truth is that God doesn't act simply because we might want him to act, and he doesn't directly intervene often. Even when he does intervene, it is not usually obvious that he does so. However, none of that should be misconstrued to mean that God is powerless to intervene and that he will not do so in his own time and to serve his own ends. The men of Israel may have thought, watching the ark being carried off to Philistia, that God really wasn't powerful enough to help them. Today's story proves that he was. God simply chose one situation to be deserving of his intervention and chose another one not to be. In this case, he would not be belittled by the Philistines. He would not be made subservient to Dagon. God was not willing to defend his entitled and disobedient children in battle, but he was willing to defend his own glory. In his action, we see that our God is not like the gods of stone served in Philistia. Psalm 135 describes them well, saying in verses 15 through 18, "The idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, they have eyes but do not see, they have ears but do not hear, nor is there any breath in their mouths. Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them." Dagon was not a god of action. Dagon was just a rock. He could do nothing more than any other rock, and neither could any of the other gods of Philistia or of Rome. And in fact, we still see today idols worshipped, for example, by the Hindus, which can do nothing. Our God is not like one of them. As was shown in today's story, Jehovah is a God who can actually do what he wants to do. And God demands respect. He allowed Israel to fall to Philistia because they refused to give him the respect due to him. He would not allow himself to be put in subservience to Dagon. Dagon fell and the Philistines who had disrespected him died for it. He wouldn't allow Israel in Beth Shemesh, perhaps sun worshippers, to disrespect him either. When they opened the box, he hit them with a plague. God is not something to toy around with. He isn't a fun activity on Sunday afternoon. His commands are not suggestions or guidelines. God demands and deserves our highest respect and obedience. And finally, I think we should note a few marks of historicity which are found in today's narrative. In chapter 5, verse 5, we have it noted that the priests of Dagon would not touch the threshold of the temple. The chapter explains why. Dagon had fallen before the ark, and his hands had touched the threshold. The passage mentions the custom of the Philistine priests in such a way that it presumes this information was known to the original audience of the text. This implies to us two things. First, the book of 1 Samuel was likely written close in time to the events in question. We don't know how long the priests of Dagon went on using that temple or how long this tradition persisted. Maybe it was relatively longer or shorter, but certainly they did not go on doing this for too long, because both the Philistines and the worship of Dagon ceased to exist about 400 years after the end setting of the book of Samuel. Second, this assertion that the Philistine priests acted in this way because of events relating to the ark was a claim which, if it were not true, would be easily falsifiable. All a reader would have to do to disprove the claim would be to ask a priest of Dagon why he doesn't touch the threshold, and if the account from the ark was... And if the account about the ark was wrong, he would hear from the Philistines the actual reason. We would not expect the author to make such a claim if it could be easily disproved, and so we expect that the original audience, likely living some 50 to 100 years after these events took place, could have expected to hear confirmation from even the Philistines, certainly hostile witnesses, that Dagon did in fact fall down before the ark. These facts lead us to the conclusion not only that the account here is true, but that it was written not long after the events in question and that the customs surrounding the account were well known in the general public and would be attested by multiple witnesses, even witnesses who would have some motivation not to confirm the veracity of the account. You can't ask for much better than that from an ancient historical document. We also note that the Philistines described in this chapter mention Israel's experience with Egypt in chapter 6, verse 6. There they mentioned that Pharaoh and the Egyptians had hardened their hearts against Jehovah and Israel, and that after Jehovah had placed severe plagues on them, they eventually sent the people of Israel away. We also saw in chapter 4 that the Philistines associated Israel's religion with the plagues of Egypt. This indicates to us that the history of the Bible was well known and received as factual history in the generations following the events it describes, and more than that, we have here internal consistency in the Bible. When the Bible references previous events, it is not inaccurate in doing so. But if the Bible were some kind of fraud or forgery from a later date, cobbled together from a variety of conflicting traditions, as some liberal scholars have claimed, we would not find the kind of internal consistency in the Bible that we do find. We could look, for example, at Mormonism and the works of Joseph Smith and the supposed prophets who followed him, and we would find a wide variance in their doctrines, their accounts of their history, and so forth. We would also find people in our era, only 150 years later, who don't agree that the history posited by the Mormons is true. This is because Mormonism and the Book of Mormon on which Smith founded the religion are frauds, and it is hard to keep a fraud internally consistent. I will note again, as I have in the past, famed filmmaker George Lucas, one man, made 6 Star Wars films while he was at the head of the franchise between the 1970s and the early 2000s. All of these were published in the course of his lifetime, and they are rife with inconsistencies, particularly in their original forms. Apparently, even one person progressively writing a story which is not true can be expected to have a hard time keeping it together. The Bible, on the other hand, is perfectly internally consistent despite having been written by over a dozen authors in multiple languages over the course of 1,000 years. It is quite impressive. Another mark of historicity in this story is the stone in Beth Shemesh, mentioned in chapter 6, verse 18. There we read, "The great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh." Again, this suggests that the passage was not written too long after the events in question. When it was written, people still knew exactly where this happened and could visit the site, and apparently did. This stone for them was like a historical marker sign that we might see set up beside a roadway. If a pilgrim had visited the stone, he could surely have asked the locals what happened there, and they could have told him. And again, this is something which the original readers could have challenged and disproved. They could have gone to the place, and if they found no stone, or if they found locals who did not corroborate the story, then they would have reason to disbelieve the author. Evidently, the author was confident in what he wrote, and the original readers trusted the account because they could verify it. I've made the analogy before that people living in Georgia, particularly anyone living around Kennesaw, would all know that during the war between the states in the 1860s, a prominent battle was fought at Kennesaw Mountain, even though it happened 170 years ago. If anyone suggested otherwise, people would think that he was just some kind of crackpot. Well, the same is true for Bible events for the people who lived not long after those events. They knew and memorialized their immediate history just as well as we know ours, and the Bible often shows signs of resonating with what was common knowledge at that time. Today, people who are farther removed from these events tend to question them, but just because historical events and the accounts of them get old doesn't mean that they become any less real or true. And I must say, we display a certain generational hubris to suppose that we, farther removed from the events, know more about them than the accounts preserved for us by the generations immediately following them. To conclude then, 1 Samuel 5, 1 through 7:2 tells the story of the ark after it was captured by Philistia and how it was returned to Israel. The story tells of how the Philistines attempted to subvert Jehovah to Dagon, only to find that Dagon was subverted to Jehovah. It also tells of how God demanded the respect of the people, both Philistines and Israelites, striking them with plagues when they showed disrespect for his holy things. And thus we learn here that God is powerful. Even following the circumstances of a battle in which God seemed not to have intervened, God eventually proved, unlike the pagan gods of the surrounding nations, his capacity to act. We must trust that God is powerful to act, and that he does so in his timing and for the ultimate best interest of his people. And also, we saw in this passage several historical markers, which both demonstrate the internal consistency of the scriptures and which help to verify the historical accuracy of their accounts.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.